name tag or tickets. There are tickets available out in the lobby. In this session, Jessie Embry is going to present her paper, Special Programs for LDS Native Americans, Lamanite Indian Branches, 1960 to 1990. And this will be followed by comments from Edward Kimball. Jessie Embry directs the Oral History Program at the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at BYU. Her Mormon Polygamous Family's Life in the Principle, published by the University of Utah Press in 1987, is based on the interviews collected by the Redd Center on LDS family life around the turn of the century. She is currently directing the collection of oral histories with LDS ethnic members. The project dealing with LDS Afro-Americans is completed, and she'll be writing a book based on those interviews. The Redd Center had just launched its LDS Native American Oral History Project and hired a Navajo from Fruitland, New Mexico last fall, when Elder George Lee was excommunicated. While some of the Native Americans have been reluctant to be interviewed until they are sure of their own feelings about the excommunication, she says that those who have been interviewed so far have been able to give their reactions to the recent developments. The paper she will present today is a preliminary study of separate ethnic branches for Native Americans. Edward Kimball is the Wilkinson Professor of Law at J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. He teaches evidence, criminal law, and criminal trial practice. He has been a member of the Utah Board of Pardons and Paroles since 1979, and he has co-authored the book Spencer W. Kimball and also the book Camilla. We'll turn the time over to Jessie Embry.
First, let me add a little detail. This session is sponsored by the Mormon History Association. The Mormon History Association has started co-sponsoring sessions at Sunstone meetings, and the reason why this one is the co-sponsor for the Mormon History Association is that I was the newsletter editor. I'm now the executive secretary, and Gary Smith didn't have another one to be sponsored by the Mormon History Association, so I volunteered it. Members of the LDS Church were stunned by Elder George P. Lee's excommunication last year. A few might have noticed the cutbacks in the Indian placement program and realized that they had not heard Elder Lee speak for a while. However, most were probably unaware that Elder Lee's relationships with the General Authority and the dialogue that he had been having with them for a number of years. The publishing of Lee's letters to the church leaders in Sunstone provided its readers a chance to draw their own conclusions about the excommunication without relying on the media, and I really appreciated that. Elder Lee was concerned about the church's reduction of programs for Native Americans. According to his letters, a member of the Council of the Twelve asked if President Spencer W. Kimball would approve of Lee's actions. Lee responded with 51 questions such as, "Who is teaching that the day of the Lamanites is over and past?" He blamed current general authorities for losing sight of what he saw as President Kimball's vision for the Lamanites. Lamanite/Indian branches, and I put that because they're called that at various different times, are examples of how the policy towards Native Americans has varied. This paper is a preliminary study of them. The research I have conducted so far reveals that there still needs to be a great deal more study, not only to understand the church's policy toward Lamanites, but also to understand how the church has responded to the needs of different ethnic members. How to deal with members of the church who speak a different language or who have a different culture than the predominant Euro-Americans has always been a dilemma. Since the church professes belief in a universal brotherhood, providing separate congregations for ethnic groups seems an unnatural separation. However, new immigrants often cannot understand English or the American culture and experience discrimination and prejudice, and so often segregated congregations are essential. Because there have been successes and failures with both combined and divided wards in the LDS Church, this policy has roller coastered. Four important factors have played a role in creating and disbanding Lamanite branches. One is the work of special Indian missions. Two is the support of Apostle Spencer W. Kimball. Three is the successes and obstacles faced by the individual branches. And fourth is the relationship between the LDS Church and the Indian tribal leaders. The first mission created to work exclusively with Native Americans started in 1935 in the Snowflake, Arizona state. During the 1940s, other states also increased their missionary efforts among LDS Americans, and in 1943, these endeavors were combined into the Navajo Zuni Mission. The name was later changed to the Southwest Indian Mission and included missionary work among a large number of Indians, not just those in the Southwest. Eventually, this mission was divided and the Northern Indian Mission was created. These Indian missions were very active in creating Lamanite branches. And at the height, according to the manuscript history, there were 57 branches in 17 districts created exclusively for Indians in the Southwest. For many, this was a fulfillment of prophecy. In 1969, for example, a missionary recorded in the manuscript history, "At the beginning of this year, it was declared by a number of people that this would be the year of the Lamanites, or the real beginning of the day of the Lamanite in the Southwest Indian Mission. The Lord is opening the work among choice believing blood of Israel." In 1945, George Albert Smith, newly appointed LDS president, asked Spencer W. Kimball to help supervise the activities of the Navajo Zuni Mission. For Apostle Kimball, this request was a special opportunity to fulfill his patriarchal blessing, quote, "You will preach the gospel to many people, but more especially to Lamanites." As George P. Lee explained in his autobiography, for many years, President Kimball was the only Indian voice in the church. Apostle Kimball fulfilled his assignment with church leaders and members. For example, he patiently explained the need to work with Lamanites to other general authorities. As late as 1962, when James D. Moyle and Gordon B. Hinckley visited the reservation for the first time, Kimball wrote in his journal, "We were sure that their eyes were open to our heeds and our progress and the work that is being done. We feel certain that much more attention will be given to this phase of the work now that they seem to be thoroughly interested in it and know more about it." After reporting a South American trip, Apostle Kimball told President David O. McKay that it was the day of the Indians, and McKay replied, "Yes, it is time, and they must hear it, and you are the one of the 12 who has the vision of it, and you are the one of the Council of the 12 who should have this work. You have my blessing." Kimball also persuaded white Latter-day Saints of their obligation to Native Americans. In a 1949 General Conference talk, he told members to care for Indians like the Good Samaritan treated the man on the side of the road. He said the only way that Euro-Americans could, quote, "justify our invasion of these Americans and our conquest of his promised land was to care for the Indians." In 1960, he told the church membership, "The day of the Lamanite is come. Government agencies, other groups, and our church have recognized their plight, and today the dark clouds are dispelling and great blessings are theirs." Apostle Kimball also helped Lamanites realize their potential. In a 1959 conference address, he told the Native Americans that the darkest time is always just before the dawn. Quote, "Your destiny is in your own hands, your friends, and the Lord's hands. Today you are finding security and education and industry. Yesterday you wandered over oceans and lost your culture and your written tongue. Today you are awakening from your long sleep and stretching and yawning and reaching. Tomorrow you will be highly trained, laying out highways and building buildings." He told the Indians attending the dedication of the Southwest Indian Mission Home that they needed to learn construction because they would play an important role in building the temple in Jackson County, Missouri. Apostle Kimball promoted Native American activities through his work on the Indian Committee, his supervisory role with the Indian Placement Program, and his assignment to the Southwest Indian Mission. When he found a successful program in an Indian branch in Cedar City, Utah, he asked William H. Manning, one of the first state missionaries called to work with the Indians in that area, to go to other places in Utah and Nevada to set up similar programs. During the 1960s, Kimball visited the Southwest Indian Missions every 4 months, where he toured with the mission president, and he gave talks, encouraged the saints, examined building sites, met with tribal leaders, and dedicated buildings. At the dedication of a Lamanite chapel in Richmond in 1971, Kimball prayed, "Father in heaven, we are grateful for the Lamanite program in thy church and that has made such great strides, and ask you to bless us that we may find the ways and means to give it greater impetus that might grow faster and more glorious than ever before." The Southwest Indian Mission presidents and Apostle Kimball encouraged the organization of Indian branches. The manuscript history of the Indian branch organized in Los Angeles in 1961 for relocated Native Americans summarizes what all these things list as the purposes of these branches. Quote, This branch was organized to provide the Lamanite members of the church with an opportunity to become active with an organized unit of the church, to mingle with their own people, to serve in positions of responsibilities, to grow in the gospel, and to have have an opportunity to socialize and progress under the influence of the church. Apostle Kimball was especially enthusiastic as he returned to the Southwest Indian Mission and saw what the Native Americans were able to accomplish in their branches. He was thrilled to see the Indian women in their native dress and was delighted to see Indian men take part in the sacrament services, commenting, "The dark faces and hair make a beautiful contrast with the white shirts." He rejoiced when Native Americans took part in meetings, especially when they played the piano, sang, and conducted the music. And if it was not always the best, he complimented them in his journal on at least their willingness to participate. He recorded after a district conference in Kienta in 1962, "It was thrilling indeed to see the beginning of what has become a standard procedure in the future with Indian leaders in branches and districts, Indians at the piano, at baton, Indians at the podium, Indians making the arrangements, Indians even furnishing the luncheons." Shirley Moore, a Native American who is from the Colorado River Reservation but who now lives in Orem, Utah, expressed some reasons why especially music was hard for Indians. When asked about unique challenges for Native Americans, she said, "For one thing, how many Indian kids are born leading music with one hand and playing the piano with the other? That's a personal challenge because we weren't raised with any kind of music. It seems that all LDS kids grew up taking piano lessons." Indian branches experienced other difficulties adjusting to LDS church procedures, and some of the differences were cultural. In summarizing a trip to the Southwest Indian Mission in 1967, Apostle Kimball wrote, quote, "The progress of the Indians in the last years is unbelievable narrowly. When I began coming to this area, the Indians were backward and timid and frightened. When we approached them, they shied off, hid their faces, stood like a post, and if we would shake hands with them, it was a cold hand they gave us. It was impossible to get them out to meetings, and especially the men. Today, many are coming out. This unbelievable change involved Indians adapting better to the white man's way of life." One difficulty was Native Americans didn't immediately adapt to the white leadership style, so often Euro-Americans were called from other wards to serve in positions. And whites often became discouraged with their efforts of attempting to work with the Indians and wanted to eliminate the programs that had been set up for the Native Americans. For example, an Indian branch was organized in Blanding, Utah in 1962, and Elder Robert L. Simpson dedicated their building in 1967. In 1971, however, the state found it impossible to staff all the organizations and concluded since there were so few Indians attending to the branch, it probably didn't need to be there and the members should be integrated into the regular wards. However, the First Presidency objected to this decision, and so full and stake missionaries were called to help with the branch. Apostle Kimball recorded several times when white leadership attempted to abandon Indian branches, and he attempted to save them. In 1965, he discussed very vigorously the total program of Duttwater, Nevada, placing the responsibility squarely upon their shoulders to see that every opportunity is given to these Indian people. Another time in Nevada, the stake leaders were discouraged in their Indian program and about to dissolve it. After a discussion, Kimball recorded, quote, "They went out with smiles, and then I'm sure they will go forward again." In Fillmore, Utah, he explained, "The branch had fallen apart, and the building has nearly been wrecked. We hoped to stimulate the state president and pour oil on the water for the Indians." There were especially problems when the Southwest Indian Mission attempted to transfer the Indian branches, which they had control of, from the missions to the local stakes. Kimball recalled, "There was some apprehension on their part, fearing that they could not handle them, and a little opposition. But after the meeting," Kimball said, "we felt that we did some good in overcoming prejudice and feel that they may desire to take two or three or more of the branches which are most adaptable." A survey of some of these branches, however, from reading the manuscript's histories, reveals that often they were dissolved after they were transferred from the mission into the stake. The problems of Indians not being able to adapt to the white church leadership program was a real quandary, though, that needed to be addressed. President Kimball and Golden Buchanan strongly favored what they called shadow leadership. According to Buchanan, "Wherever we could, I'd like to have at least one missionary or one Anglo who has been in the church a long time serve with another leader. He would be the assistant, and maybe we would do 90% of the work, but we wanted the Indians to feel that it was his responsibility. This sometimes led to Indian resentment. When a branch was organized in the Poston Parker area of Arizona, the mission leadership felt, since most of the brethren were new in the church and all of them were Lamanites, maybe an advisor would work out very well, and therefore a white couple was asked to assist. This continual use of whites caused Shirley Moore, whose father-in-law and later husband served as branch president. They were given the leadership position, but at the time that when she was in high school and went to the Preston branch, all the leaders were white. Because, and she says in her interview, of course the Indians couldn't be leaders. What did they know? I'm being sarcastic. The Indians from the Colorado River Reservation also expressed another concerns about the branches. When a branch was being considered for the Parker-Poston area, the Southwest Indian leadership argued that although the white saints didn't want the chapel on the reservation in Poston, the Indians would not go to church in Parker. Eventually, they established two branches, one in Poston and one in Parker. And according to Golden Buchanan, the Poston branch thrived under the direction of the Moors. In fact, the Poston branch was doing so much better than the Parker branch that President Buchanan wanted to combine the two branches and put them both in Poston. That change did not take place while Buchanan was mission president, though, and when a branch was eliminated, it was the Poston branch, Poston Indian branch, that was eliminated. And this caused a great deal of anxieties for the Native Americans. According to Shirley Moore, there was a lot of prejudice in Parker. After the Poston branch was dissolved, many of the Indians went inactive, and Moore felt she understood why. And she said in her interview, quote, "I never felt comfortable in Parker. Never, ever, ever, not even when we go back now. I still feel uncomfortable there. I think it's because there's so much prejudice in Parker. Listen to me railing on those people who won't go to church in Parker, and yet I feel the same way." But not all the differences were culture. Some of them can only be described as prejudice. This is a quote which comes from a white clerk wrote it in the manuscript history of a Lamanite branch. The branch was in Nevada. And he wrote, quote, "When one considers the fact that 60% of the reservation residents are alcoholics and the rest drink, with the exception of a very few, including teenagers down to 14 years of age, we can see cause for much of the violence on the reservation." It's hard to imagine him working really closely with Indians with that kind of attitude towards the people that he was working with. Indian branches also faced extreme opposition from other churches and from tribal councils. According to Spencer W. Kimball, "We have tried some time ago to get a youth program going, and the youth of the community have responded well. But the people from the other churches seem to stop everything. It seems that the Catholic priests and the Reformed Christian leaders would rather have the children go to hell than rather than have them trained by our missionaries in paths of right." This problem persisted throughout the 1950s and 1960s. Golden Buchanan, the mission president in 1953, recalled going to a meeting of the Navajo Advisory Committee at Window Rock, Arizona. The manuscript history explained, "This time, instead of being mean and vindictive, great courtesy was given and many kind things said about the church." But the trouble was not over. Buchanan recalled that the Navajo council chair at that time, and I don't know how to say his name, Sam Akiha, would be very lukewarm towards, and then sometimes even cold, and another week he'd be completely our friend. For example, the church was denied the request to build a chapel at Greenwood, Arizona, because a few people opposed it. And the historian complained that because there had to be unanimous support, quote, "instead of being a democracy, it had to be a complete unity before they could move ahead." In 1955, the Navajo Nation held an election, and the current Navajo council leader was defeated by Paul Jones. The manuscript history explained that 4,000 Navajo LDS members had voted for Jones because he and his running mate, Scott Preston, had promised to treat the Mormons better. Things improved some under Jones, although the church continued to have problems getting building sites because the Navajo Tribal Council argued that some people in the town were opposed to having the chapels there. In 1960, the church made a public relations movie to convince the Navajo Council that they were serving the needs of its people. An employee of that council, Sam Billingson, who worked with the council, came to Salt Lake to see the film upon their shoulders. Jones, the tribal leader, backed out of coming at the last minute. Later, Spencer W. Kimball took the movie to show the Navajo Tribal Council, and Kimball recalled that when he went to Window Rock, it was with wonder and with some misgivings and some very sober ideas, realizing what was at stake. He added that for 15 years or more, we've been asking for recognition of the church and its programs of proselyting and organizing, but to date that has been frowned upon and discouraged, and efforts have been made to get us off the reservation. At first they couldn't show the movie at the time that was allotted, and President Kimball was really concerned that something was going to happen to prevent them to be able to show the movie. However, the council took a coffee break, and when they came back, they were able to show the movie. And because it was right after a break, they got full attention. And Apostle Kimball felt that it was a real blessing. At another meeting in 1962, Kimball could report, quote, "We were well received, quite a new situation after all the rebirths that we've had, and the Indians seemed willing to work with us." The very next year, in 1963, a stake center was built, and the mission president explained that it was the first of its kind in the mission and the fourth building in 4 years. Adding that 20% of the work had been done by labor missionaries, President Edwin Baird explained, "Navajos can help show the church and the tribe that we mean business. Your lives and testimonies will go into this building and it will belong to you. It is the beginning of a great program in the world, the Indian program. This building program is a beginning step for your children to build the New Jerusalem." By 1966, there was a strong opinion expressed by all that there would have no more problems in obtaining sites for buildings on the Navajo reservation from then on. However, just a year later, there was an opposition to a chapel in Tahiti, and the tie vote had to be broken by the vice chair and chairman of the meeting. And he did approve the application. And during 1968, a number of chapels were built. The earlier number of branches that I quoted, the 57 branches on the in the Southwest, came after the church was given permission to build these buildings on the Navajo Reservation. Building chapels on the Navajo Reservation did not end all tension. The church continued to have problems with the Hopis. When the church could not find a place to build a chapel in 1964 in Kings Canyon, Spencer W. Kimball reported, "It was a strange situation when the Lord of heaven and earth, who has organized this world, to whom the whole earth belongs, could not get a spot of ground in which to build a chapel for his purposes." Conditions changed, however, and by 1972, the church was able to build a chapel in Hopi land. Just as things were improving for the church on the reservation, though, the church was rethinking its policy of ethnic branches. It was not a sudden move. The topic had been debated for years. Some general authorities thought it was better to have the members integrated. Others felt that too many members were lost if there were not ethnic branches. In a very rare moment, when Spencer W. Kimball mentioned in detail what happened in the Council of 12 meeting, he explained, "I was so vigorous in my protest against eliminating ethnic branches that the president did not take a vote on it." Later, the matter was referred to the Indian and Minority Committee, which Kimball chaired, and while he did not get complete support there, he did get the matter tabled. Golden Buchanan, who worked with the Indian and Minority Group Committee, explained that there are those on the committee that think everything should be integrated. But the shift from ethnic branches did come. In 1972, the Lamanite branches at BYU were abolished, and the same year a circular letter went out to all the stakes, which many interpreted to mean that they should take care of their own ethnic groups within their own wards. Stuart Durant, who was then working with the Indian committee, argued that this policy was damaging and the church was losing members. And by 1977, with the introduction of what's called the Basic Unit Plan, the idea of ethnic branches was back. But the debate did not end, and because there are strong points for and against the special units, it will probably continue. The fate of Indian branches will continue to be intermixed with this debate about ethnic branches. My beginning studies show that separate branches for Native Americans were organized through the efforts of the Southwest Indian Mission and Apostle Spencer W. Kimball. These congregations had unique concerns and obstacles which determined whether or not they were continued. One of the largest obstacles, Hopi and other Native American tribes to the church. As the tribal councils allowed chapels on the reservation, more branches could be organized. But whether or not there were separate branches depended on the view of the general authorities on ethnic branches at the time, and their policy varied. This dilemma continues not only for the church leaders, but also for the Native Americans. Navajo Robert Hatch used to attend the Alma Lamanite branch in Kirtland, New Mexico. It's Alma, but everyone from that branch says Alma. Since the branch was dissolved and he was asked to attend a geographical ward, he no longer goes. When asked why he had become inactive, he said, "For me, it was dissolving this Lamanite branch. I just miss it so much. It was joyous. It was a friendly feeling to go there. It's really sad to see it interrupted now." So he felt this need for the branch. He was inactive because the branch wasn't there. But then the interviewer asked him if he was the state president and he could do anything that he wanted to for Navajos in that area, what would he do? And he said, "I don't know if I'd make a big deal about Indians or Navajos. Maybe our Lamanite branch that we used to have wasn't such a good idea. It kept us separated for all these years for no reasons, really. Well, I'm sad that Almas is gone. I think it's good that we're all mixed in like this." For Ernestine Lynch, who also attended the Alma branch, other Navajos are family, and she wants to worship with them just as she wants to go to church with her children. Since the excommunication of Elder Lee, Ernestine, who should attend a branch in Kirtland, attends a Shiprock ward, which is nearly all Navajo, because Shiprock is nearly all Navajo. Lynch, a history graduate student at BYU and a teacher in the high school at Farmington, New Mexico, has little trouble blending with the Euro-American society, yet she'd rather worship with, quote, her people. Other more traditional Navajos do not mingle as well, and they might refuse to go to church rather than attend an Anglo ward. Yet, well, how will whites learn more about Navajos and accept them as individuals if they don't have to interact with them? There are no easy solutions for these questions. Thank you.
Jesse's labeled her paper a preliminary study, and that, of course, is what it is. One might wish that it were fleshed out, and I guess ultimately it will be. It's part of a much larger picture. As Jesse has described her work, it is clear that it relates only to the southwestern United States. There are other Indian groups, other Indian reservations, other Indian branches in the country, and it will be interesting to see whether the problems and solutions are similar elsewhere as they have been in the five southwestern states that comprise the whole of her study. There are also questions about Navajos in the cities. We've been talking or been hearing almost exclusively about the Navajos either on or next to the reservation. There was reference to the one Los Angeles branch. That's something I hope that she'll be able to pursue. There are also some interesting chronological questions. A number of Indians, of course, were baptized in the pioneer days. Some of them were adopted as members of white families. My great-grandfather had at least one Indian child in his home, and they grew up really as part of the dominant culture to the extent they remained in those homes. But there were also a great many Indians who were baptized and continued tribal life. I have no idea what happened to them, what kind of church activity, if any, they maintained, or whether it was merely an expression of allegiance to the Mormons as opposed to the Americans. The study that Jesse has embarked on here is part of any number of bigger topics, like criteria for organizing church units, or dealing with differences in the church, or one that you might think of as nationalism in an international church, that is, different cultures, different national allegiances, and even within a country, different cultural or ethnic allegiances that are creating some kinds of stresses on the unity that the church desires. Jesse documents four factors that affect the organization of Indian branches, and maybe it's worthwhile to go over them once more and see in which direction they push. One of them is the Indian missions, mission presidents called to work specifically with Indians. It seems to me that pushes almost inevitably in the direction of separate branches. To some extent, where the branches are going to be located within the heart of a reservation, as large as the Navajo reservation, they will be Indian by necessity, since there are very few whites living on the reservation itself. But others out on the fringes of the reservation where there is a white population nearby could go either way. My guess is that the Indian missionaries, however, would see their loyalties to the Indian group and would probably find that that their objectives are better served, closer ties with separate branches. I don't know that to be true, but that's a surmise. The factor about tribal responses works in one way. That is, it really only can push in the direction of integrated branches, because if they are reluctant to give building sites within the reservation where the segregated or separate branches could be established, that pushes the Indians to the periphery and would necessarily result in integration or no very substantial church organization at all. It might be that there simply isn't an effective branch organized because they have no place to meet. With respect to Spencer Kimball, Jesse identifies him as having been generally in favor of separate branches. As an apostle with a special assignment to look after the Indians, I think that was his preference. The 1972 letters that Jesse referred to appeared to favor integration, however, with the abolition of Lamanite branches at BYU and the stakes told that cultural differences should not result in the creation of separate branches. When President Kimball assumed that office at the end of 1973, one might have looked for some change, some new direction, now that he had more influence in the way that things should go. I'm not aware whether there was change. It certainly was not a dramatic one. Jesse tells us that there was, at the height, 57 branches, but we don't have any sense of the ebb and flow. That is, did they increase and increase again and decrease? Maybe we don't have enough data to plot it, but it would be interesting on a chronological scale to see when and how the numbers increased and decreased, and to see whether with a man in position of prime responsibility who had previously fostered separate branches, there was a rise again. If he left things unchanged, that could be the result of a couple of things. One is that he thought that the new direction was the right direction for the time, or it could be that he simply was consumed with other responsibilities and gave, as I think is the case, at least much less attention to Indian affairs in the church, having now responsibility for the whole range of responsibilities to which the president falls heir. The fourth is clearly, in my judgment, the most important of the factors, and that is the success and failure of separate and integrated branches. I believe that the experience was mostly failure. That is, the problems were difficult problems. And what we ended up with is a kind of pendulum, branches being organized and disorganized and organized again. And I think it results from trying to find a better solution. That is, failure tends to push us in the direction of trying something else. So if we try separate branches and that doesn't work, then we'll try integrated branches. And if that doesn't work, well, we'll try separate branches again. And that may account for some of it. Quixotically, if you don't have complete success or complete failure, you don't really know what to do. That is, if I'm doing pretty well, but I try a different scheme, will I do even better? Or if I am relatively failing, should I try something else, or maybe that'll make me do even worse? The mere fact that thing is doing pretty well or pretty poorly is not a prescription for stability or change. It leaves us really with questions unanswered, unless you are unwilling to take any risks and say, well, whatever I'm doing now, I'll stick with it. Our objective, of course, in the church is to bring all people to follow Christ. And the question is whether separate branches or integrated church units for Indians is the more effective means of achieving that end. President Kimball's judgment early on was that separate branches were better, but I don't think that ought to be taken as an indication of what he would do if he were to make the same kind of decisions today. Things change. And I believe that ultimately the decision ought not to be a global one. It ought not to be a church-wide one. It ought to be essentially a local one. I can suggest there are three factors, at least, in considering whether to establish separate church units. I suggest borrowing from Neil Maxwell's alliteration that they are prejudice, patience, and preference. First is to prejudice. The gospel is hard to live in isolation. The gospel involves us with other people, human interaction. But the gospel can be lived well in a segregated group. An Indian branch on the reservation doesn't, I think, have any difficulty in living the principles of the gospel, even though there are few, if any, whites involved with them in their branch. It is, however, true that if a basic principle is for us to love all men and to avoid judgment, particularly the kind of group judgment that results from stereotypes, then that's a little harder to do in isolation because separateness leads us to lesser understanding of other people. Christ's parable of the Good Samaritan is a prime example of the value of people overcoming their stereotypes. His interchange with the Samaritan woman at the well, or Peter's vision of the unclean beasts, all of these remind us that that prejudice is one of the great sins, and that until we can all worship and serve together without barriers raised by prejudice, we haven't really internalized this basic gospel principle. But I'd like to suggest that the key is that we're not living the gospel fully until we can worship together. But that doesn't necessarily mean we must worship together. For example, I worship very happily together with my neighbors, and yet if I had a choice, I would enjoy even more worshiping together with my own family. And so it is not prejudice against my neighbors that leads me to prefer doing things of this sort with my family when the alternatives are before me. And so I don't think we ought to see separate branches as some bearing some label of prejudice. It may be simply a matter of enhancing. The key is for us not to be offended if people who are different from us occupy the seat next to us or participate with us in a Sunday school class discussion. There are lots of things that divide us that produce hurtful stereotypes: race, language, culture, nationality, gender, politics, social and economic status. The focus of this session, of this paper, really is race and culture. But what Jesse has to teach us about Indian branches has relevance to the much broader range of questions as well. Between Indians and whites, or Anglos, I think most of the prejudice is on one side. And yet there is often prejudice reflected back. That is, Indians are not without their prejudices. They often are simply mirroring what they have felt. And being rejected, they reject. This is not uncommon experience. So the problem is not all on one side, though I think it is largely so. Where prejudice is high, as was true in the Poston area that Jesse described, it may well be that separate branches are the right answer. Because where there is prejudice, the relationships between majority and minority are going to be so strained, or maybe so strained, that the branch will not operate effectively. It becomes a place of discomfort rather than a place of happy communion with neighbors, friends, fellow worshipers. So that perhaps where there is prejudice, separateness is better, and both groups need to work on the enhancement of their understanding. President Kimball's sermon when he was a general authority on tolerance was one of the my favorites of all his addresses. It was a powerful plea to accept Indians specifically. Later, when it was published in Faith Precedes the Miracle, he inserted a paragraph to broaden that plea to tolerance for other races, blacks and browns, as well as red and white. But his original focus, because that was his assignment at the time, was on trying to reduce the prejudice against Indians. That's one of the major tasks for us as members of a majority community. A preachment about prejudice goes only so far. We really have to work it out in our individual lives. We have to internalize it. We have to experiment with it to learn that people are not as they have been painted by stereotypes. For example, I think that the 1978 revelation might have come then because we had finally, as a group, been able to put behind us some of the prejudice that had been part of our culture. There still is racial prejudice in the church. I don't hear it often, but I hear it enough to know that it's not been rooted out among us. The second consideration, aside from the degree of prejudice, is patience. I think I'm not unlike other people. I can do better with a short burst of hard work than I can over the long pull with a responsibility that never goes away. And with respect to branches of the sort we've been talking about, almost by definition, an Indian branch will struggle. It will be a difficult organizational unit. It's partly in the nature of a small unit, as most of those branches, I think, were. It'll be largely made up of new members with relatively little experience. And a Caucasian branch, under similar circumstances, would struggle also. That is, it's not unique to Indian branches, except that nearly all Indian branches have this characteristic, and only a relatively smaller number of Anglo branches would go through that. But the struggle is likely to be even greater because the program and the organizational expectations are developed for an Anglo culture. The kind of way we set up, the kind of social activities that we expect, the Mayamade lessons and so on, are all geared for a particular cultural background. It isn't just Indian branches that will struggle with that. It's also South American or South African branches and that have those problems, but we're focused on this particular thing. For a separate Indian branch to succeed, then, there almost has to be great patience on the part of the Anglo leaders who will work with them. The stake leaders are likely to see this branch as taking a disproportionate amount of their time and as providing relatively small measure of satisfaction from success, and it will reduce the statistics by which we are sometimes judged. And those are all reasons why it's not a favorite activity, probably, of stake presidents to focus on the needs of these struggling Indian branches. Of course, if there are integrated branches, those are going to require patience on the part of the ward leaders more than the stake leaders. In just the same ways, they're likely to be working with Indian members as demanding, unproductive, and unsatisfying. Stake and ward leaders are heavily loaded, as many of you will know from personal experience. And when pressed for time and energy to carry out their tasks, I think they, in very human terms, are tempted to neglect that part of the job of the ward membership that's perceived as difficult and less productive, less satisfying. And they don't expect to find among Indian members a lot of help in staffing the organizations, which is part of a bishop's unending work. It's a vicious cycle. Indian members get very little experience because they don't have much experience. Like trying to get your first job. Where have you worked before? Indian members don't have the administrative background, typically. And as teachers, their culture makes them retiring, often shy, and it stands in the way of their being satisfying teachers to the people sitting in the congregation who expect from a TV generation that teachers are going to be dynamic and entertaining. And I believe that Indian Sunday school teachers, as a group, are less likely to do that than people who have a different cultural set. And so the have-nots continue to be have-nots because they have not. Ward leaders want to give everybody responsibility. I know that from experience. They'd love to have everybody in the ward have a job, and yet some people, without much experience, without much personal power, tend to be difficult to place in any but the most mechanical of positions. See, bishops and other leaders have dual responsibilities. They do want to see people grow through the experience of leadership and teaching, administration, but they also need to have an organization that runs for the benefit of the consumers. And If there is difficulty in obtaining just the right balance in respect to those competing demands, if the organizations are run poorly, if the lessons are taught less than well, then the members begin to stay away, and so you're sacrificing some for the interest of others. The transfer of Indian branches to an Anglo stake is likely to be difficult, for the reasons that I've indicated. When an Anglo stake gets an Indian branch, there are these pressures that lead to a desire to dilute the responsibility by breaking that down. And it takes years of patient effort. And there are some people who have that capacity and others who don't. Where the patience does not exist in sufficient quantity, I think the pressure is very great for the abolition of the separate branches and for the integration. And in the integrated wards, branches, I think the pressure is to neglect those Indian members who are not perceived as yet having adopted the characteristics of the dominant culture. A third factor that I suggested as relevant is preference. That's an alliteration by which I really want to talk about the desirability of making a unit a home, a place where people want to be, where they are among friends or people like them so that they're comfortable. Some of the last quotations that Jesse read had to do with people feeling at home being among their own racial group. Other things being equal, and they rarely are, it's better to let people be where they want to be. And yet the church has a general policy of assigning people to a ward and expecting them to go there. There's a balance being struck there. It is that people ought not to select for themselves with what group they will adhere, because that lends to that leads to prejudice. That leads to the perpetuation of prejudice. It leads to stratification of the church. I think that the desirability is for us to learn all to share together and be comfortable together. But over the years, as Jesse mentioned, there have been many special organizational units, ones for singles, for students, for racial groups, for members who are deaf, people who speak foreign languages. And aside from that, there are also a lot of de facto groups. Wherever the church is populous, as it is, for example, in Provo or Salt Lake City, there is a major socioeconomic stratification. The ward in Federal Heights in Salt Lake City is quite a different place than a ward on the west side near the railroad tracks. And in my ward in Provo, it's right next to the university and is largely populated by university-oriented people. And so you have socioeconomic, even some kind of subcultural characteristics of a ward. That is, I think, the result of deliberate policy choice, I'm not offering criticism of that. But the church also has these special units for singles and students and so on, as a compromise between an all-or-nothing proposition. You go within the four lines of your ward boundary, or you don't go. And the Indian branches are, of course, that kind of accommodation. There's always a recurring question in setting ward boundaries, as I've been involved a number of times. Do you draw the line so that you've got upper and lower economic groups on the assumption that they will be comfortable together? Or do you cut across those so that you have half rich and half poor? That's less often a problem with wards than it is with stakes, because if you have wards and have not wards in a stake, there are a lot of there are some stresses that you can avoid if there are greater similarities among the wards in the stake. I could list a lot of problems and benefits of separate units and of integrated units. I won't do that because of the limited time. But I would like to read some excerpts from a report that that relates to the church decision on branches with respect to Indians. This is from some years ago, so it does not purport to describe what would go on in a similar discussion today. But this is from an advisory committee I'll quote and read as much as seems to make sense in terms of time. As Indians joined the church, numerous organizational units for Indian members were created. In other areas, the Indians met together simply because they felt more comfortable being with members of their own cultural group. These Indian units were organized in many areas on and off the reservation, wherever sufficient numbers seemed to justify such organizations. Most were housed in their own facilities. Wards and branches for Indian members were created in metropolitan centers as well as on or adjacent to reservations. Generally, non-Indian priesthood leaders were called to preside over these units with the admonition to train Indian members to replace them. It was hoped that these Indian units would provide a transition to full responsibility and acceptance for Indians among the general church membership. More recently, many of these church units have been discontinued and their membership has been integrated into the regular wards. In most instances, the result of this has been decreased participation on the part of Indian members. We've demonstrated it's not difficult to baptize large numbers of Indians. Considering the number who have been baptized in the last 15 years, we have not been as successful as we should be in developing Indian leaders in the church. While the more recent integration of Indian members among non-Indians in many areas can possibly be pointed to as one of the reasons for this, it must honestly be noted that most Indian units were failing badly long before the integration occurred. Even in those units where Indians were installed initially as leaders in priesthood and auxiliary organizations, there were few sustained successes. It has seemed that the complex structure of church organization and the wide range of diversified responsibility placed upon Indian leadership has proved too demanding and too frustrating for them with their limited background and experience. In order to enjoy the full blessings of church membership, Indians must be in the mainstream. Special programs which lack the solid backing and understanding of the general church leadership have not proved successful. They're not long sustained. Attention should be given to simplifying organizational structure in Indian units, including a simplified reporting system, so that Indian leaders can assume responsibility and be successful. Our efforts of the past to install non-Indian leaders who demonstrate how the church operates for non-Indians has been notably unsuccessful. A careful evaluation should be made of the possible need for allowing Indian members in predominantly non-Indian areas to have their own organizations. Nothing should be done in this respect to encourage and perpetuate a separateness of Indians from non-Indians, but an analysis should be made of the circumstances. Each case should be considered on its own merit. That gives the flavor of the kind of concerns that went on in a major church committee trying to grapple with this very question. The conclusion to which they came may or may not be church policy. I have no idea. But it is consistent with my own notions that individualized, localized decision is important, that will reflect something about the degree of prejudice that there is between races, the degree of patience that there is in the leaders who will be called upon to take responsibility for what may be difficult circumstances, at least burdensome tasks, and the wishes of the people in terms of what makes them comfortable and happy in their church life. Jesse's study is part of a much larger work that she has done and is doing on how minority group members fit into the larger church. I note particularly her article in the recent issue of Dialogue, which you ought to read if you're interested in this subject and haven't yet read. This relates to black wards and branches, and it does what I hope she'll be able to do with respect to the Indian branches. The fleshing out of the issues, the considerations that are in that, can be transferred to this study also of Indian branches. It is a fine piece of work, and this is the beginning of another piece of that large puzzle of our trying to understand and realize the ideal of a church in which there are no Lamanites or otherites, but we are all children of God together. I appreciate the beginning that Jesse has made on further exploration of this important subject.
We only have about 5 minutes for questions, but I'll be around if you want to ask other questions later.
Yeah, I have one I really, because I think we have very different images of what leadership is in a culture.
That's what I was trying to say, and you know, because of time limits, I didn't expand on it, but that's exactly what I was trying to say with the quote from President Kimball, where he talks about how leadership, how the Indians had changed, how they used to be posts and now they're more open and willing to come to meeting, is simply a difference in culture. And that's exactly the problem that the mission leaders didn't understand when the Navajo tribe insisted that there be complete support for having a building, that kind of working togetherness that isn't possible.
I didn't mean that as a criticism.
Oh,
I
no.
I thought there were elements in both of your comments that key on this. I just
right.
Emphasize it.
Right. And it does need to be emphasized more. Linda? That's some of the responses. Those that really have negative reactions to Elder Lee's excommunication, that's the response. Partly, you know, they see him as the leaders. Others, I think probably because we're a long way away from when the time when he was ordained, just simply seem to say he's an individual. We didn't really see him in that kind of a leadership role. I think we need to close because there'll be another session coming in, but I'll be happy to answer any questions.